too soon. You're just two umbrellas one late afternoon. You don't know the next thing you will say. This is your favorite kind of day. It has no walls. The beauty of the rain is how it falls, how it falls, how it falls. And there's nothing wrong, but there is something.
Okay. This is Dee Dee with Big Little Questions. You are listening to Midwave Radio, and I am here with my good friend Akiva, and we are going to be talking about some questions that we don't know which ones yet. Are you good with choosing them randomly from our short list?
Yeah, it sounds good.
Okay, great. Okay, so this is week number, I don't know, of Big Little Questions. I know it's been kind of inconsistent this summer, but happy to be back at you with another pre-recorded show. And just to introduce my friend Akiva, who I'm so lucky to be doing this live with and in person with. Akiva, we have known each other for 7 years, maybe? And
something like that.
But it really is in the last year that I think we have become friends. I don't think that we'd had more than a couple conversations before that. And yet, now you are someone who I've seen the majority of days in the last year, probably. Something like that. I feel like it's funny to be saying, usually when I'm saying these things to people, it's over the phone, which is less forward than saying them to their face, but I feel very acutely sad that you are about to be leaving for a long time, because you have been, and remain, but have been, like, such a good friend in the last year. And, like, every single time that I see you, I'm really happy to see you. Like, so happy. And, like, it just, I think, learning from / experiencing the way that you interact with the world and with other people, and, like, it is very different from my pace in a literal way. Like, I speak much faster. You speak much slower. When we rated ourselves according to who speaks most quick and most slow, I was the quickest, you were the slowest. And just, like, I always feel like I have to respond to everything quickly and respond to people quickly, and you are kind of the opposite. And it is, like, really something that I have, like, learned a lot from being in friendship with you. So that is one kind of starting introductory point that I'll say. And also that every time I talk to you, I afterwards or during words, I'm just, like, happy that that's what I'm doing. And then one more special thing, which is that you were our first Shabbos dinner guest outside of our pod this year. And I remember being so happy about that. And also that you stayed on our couch until, like, 2 a.m. hanging out. And I don't think that I really lived in that apartment until that had happened, because that's, like, really my measure for, like, what is home. And so you have the, and of course it's so fitting that it's you, but you have the grand high honor of having caused our home to become a home for me.
Yeah, that all means so much. I really appreciate the time that we've been able to spend together, and also, like, just seeing your smile whenever we see each other, it's, like, it's really makes my whole day, and, like, really, you know, is one of the things that brings me back to the lake when I come back, and, yeah.
I mean, okay, well, for all those reasons and more, I hope it's clear why I'm excited to have you on the show. And now we get to do the fun part where we choose a random number and see what question that takes us to.
Alright.
So, okay, I'm going to not multitask. I'm just going to do this for just a moment. You can talk if you have anything to say. I just can't, because I won't do anything. Well, I guess the doc is loading. I'll say what I often am thinking in this moment while it's loading, which is that I always am, like, in the moment of choosing a random number, I'm like, oh, it turns out there is one that I'm hoping for, or one that I'm...
right at the last moment.
Hoping against.
Right when it's too late.
Yeah, exactly. It's never too late. Okay, we are at this. Or you can also choose a number between 1 and 9.
No, random.
Random? Okay. Actually, 1 to 8. Random number.
Yeah.
Between 1 and 8.
I kind of hope that, like, God might be present in this conversation, so this is the first opportunity for God to enter.
Do you want to hear what the answer is?
What's the answer?
Or what the question is, rather? Can you read it? It's number 2.
What do we owe home?
Okay, first, what's your initial, like, were you, was that one of the ones that you were, did you have a relationship to it of secret hoping or anti-hoping?
I think it's kind of related to some of the other questions that I selected. I feel like I selected a lot of questions that were not necessarily, like, on their face related, but could, like, flow from one to the other. Yeah.
Can you pitch this question to us?
Okay. So, I mean, it's just, it's presenting, some very important concept that we have for what guides what actions we take. You know, there's a lot of different ways to think about, like, what should we do, like, what should we not do, and owing something is one of those ways. And it's, you know, it's always good to, like, investigate, like, what does this concept actually mean, and how am I approaching it, and how, like, is it actually helpful, or is something that is maybe similar or has the same positives but not some of the same negatives actually might be better for choosing these kinds of decisions.
I don't know the date that this question is, like, from in this document, but I have a memory of my first year of college having a conversation with someone with whom I had a kind of, like, contentious relationship, or, like, just kind of a complicated relationship. And I said something to the effect of, like, you know, I think we owe each other more than that or something. And they were like, people don't owe each other things. And I was like, whoa, that is really far from how I think about things. And I think I had an extreme reaction to it in the sense that I was like, so you think we don't have anything, people don't have anything to do with other people? And, but I don't think that's what they were saying. I think they were probably saying something closer to what you just were alluding to, which is there a concept different than owing that we might use to, like, conceive of our relationship to one another? This, I think, and then I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this, like, I guess right now as we're speaking, I guess I hear in the word owe, or in the concept of owing, a, like, well, I think inherent in that is, like, a debt, right? Like, what debt do we have to each other? And I don't know why I've never thought this before this moment, but I can kind of see why that's, like, maybe not such an appealing way to think of it, because what is the relationship of, like, a debtor? Debtor?
Right.
What, how do you say that word? Debtor?
Yeah.
I don't know. And it's, like, one of, like, power over someone else, or power, or you, like...
Right. And also one where the... basically, the feelings that can motivate actions are sort of removed and replaced with a sort of ledger. Like, a kind of... relationship where you're keeping track of things and where you're counting up things. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So then that brings me to thinking about when Tali Ginsberg was on the show a couple months ago. I don't remember what the question was that we were talking about, but we had some conversation about, like, is there a moral value to, like, what motivates our actions? Like, is it better for it to be feelings than something else? Because we talk about it in that way where we're like, how can you be so callous? How can you not care about justice? How can you this? How can you that? And that, like, is that actually as useful as, like, material like thinking about motivation or things in a material way. So I guess this brings me, I guess the question that I'm asking about that is like, either in a like, do you have a sense of the morals of this, or like, do you have an emotional reaction to one way versus the other way of conceiving of like, of relationship as like, ledgerly versus,
yeah.
versus something softer than owing? I don't know.
No, I do think that I have a philosophy about this that is very important, which also, I mean, if I can bring in the justice question, I think that they're related in that both, like...
The justice question being...
Being... The question itself is, why do some people not care about justice?
Something like that.
But it could be also, like, thought about in the same way, like what... What is justice, and like what does it do for us, and what does it take away from our ability to do? And I think specifically like the idea of debt and the idea of justice both come from this concept that there are certain things that happened in the past that sort of determine what is right and wrong in the present. So there are things that either would be totally wrong or would be sort of optional, but that are required because of situations that happened in the past. And this is, I mean, the past is very important for me. It's
that's
like,
why.
I am an archaeologist, and
by trade,
and the past is hugely important for my thinking. But also, I think that when situations in the past are taken as a part of what is right or wrong in the present, it does a lot more to take away from the goodness that can be achieved in the world.
Can I ask a concrete version of
yeah.
that? So, when you think about that in something like our modern American political landscape,
yeah.
for example, what is the implication for like, yeah, what is the implication of that? Or like, can you make it concrete by giving an example of like something that right now draws from the past in order to tell us what the correct present action should be, but you actually think it would be lead to more overall goodness to not do that?
Okay, I think it's going to be hard to think of a present example that doesn't immediately bring up a lot of closely felt issues that might take away from the question.
Fair. We can put ourselves on leashes.
But
now I'm imagining, you know, when you see like little kids that are like all on one leash, like a bunch of 4-year-olds. Now I'm imagining all of us who hang out at the lake, but like shrunk down to like a foot and a half tall. Okay, go on.
But I mean, for one thing, the idea of punishment is very linked to this, right? It's like punishment is the definition of something that is morally wrong, but is justified by something that happened in the
uh-huh.
past. And basically the way I see the world is that the negative things that people put into the world cause more negative things to happen, and the positive things that people put in the world cause more positive things to happen. And I think one of the issues with justice and desert is that there's a limited amount of goodness in the world, and it has to be apportioned to the people who deserve it most. And it's not how I see the world. In my understanding, the more goodness that is done, the more goodness there is to be done. And the same thing is for the more pain that is caused, the more people are sort of forced to make decisions that cause more pain.
So this is actually kind of like a pretty radical, like, abundance mindset, like, anti-scarcity, right? Like, that's, I feel like that fundamentally that is what I'm hearing. I see you emphatically nodding.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, that's right.
yeah, radio doesn't catch that. Yeah. Right, like, fundamentally, it's like, if we are thinking of, like, justice and goodness, or rather, the problem with justice, we get into stuckness and into holes only when we think of things as, like, limited goods. And then, just to connect this, or ask the question of, like, okay, what is that?
It looks like they're coming
to shut
the bathrooms.
When I think about that in relationship to the question of owing one another, like, maybe something fundamental about that question is that it could only be asked in, like, a, like, falsely scarce world such as ours, because in a non-scarce world where, like, goodness is not scarce and the kinds of things that we might conceive of owing each other are not scarce, then we wouldn't even have to have the question of, like, what do we owe each other, because we are,
right.
like, not only because there is enough to go around, but because, like, by the definition of that world, we are doing things for and with each other and not in, like, a ledgerly manner. I don't know if that made sense.
Right, and also, like,
ledgerly manner.
It's kind of like the positive feedback loop versus the negative feedback loop. In the positive feedback loop, the more you do something, the more it can be done and the more it is done.
Yeah.
In the negative feedback loop, the more you do something, the less it can be done. And I think that's the kind of shift that I'm talking about. If you think that it's good to do something good for someone, it is good to do something good for that person, I think. It's good to do something good for everyone. And also, even if in this world of positive feedback loops, you can think about, it's especially good for me to do something good for a certain person. If you're doing good for anyone, that will also increase the good that comes to any individual
person. And the capacity for goodness.
Right, right. Because every time a good thing is done, the person who was on the receiving end is more likely to do something good for someone else.
So I have a question about how the... So one reaction I have when I hear this is I'm like, oh, how lovely and nice. And one reaction I have is like, oh yeah, that also aligns with how I think about, like, love and friendship, which I can say more about in a second. But another reaction that I have is that, like, yeah. I can hear... I feel like this too easily for my comfort reduces into a kind of, like, individualist, like... Everyone just has to do, like, you know, a good thing, or, like, good things for other people, which I feel like is not a bad thing, but it's kind of like it's not about building, that doesn't, like, build power that changes systems that causes there to be more good for more people over time. Like, I think, does that make sense as a, or, like, do you understand what I'm saying?
It does make sense.
Okay. Do you want to respond to it?
It does make sense. So the idea is, like, if we're not all concertedly doing the thing for the person to whom it's owed the most, then we're all doing our own things and it's scattered and it's
like distributing something in an ineffective way and
yeah.
it's not causing there to be a concentration of the increase in the capacity for more goodness to be done.
Right. So my response to that is that every time that a person does a good thing for another person, they are creating a bond with that person.
Yes.
And that, to me, is the most important thing for large-scale good to occur. And even if you conceive of things in an organizing way, the most important thing is the networks of bonds that exist between people. And when a person does an action that is like what Art Scroll would call loving kindness. a kindness out of love and you know, purely out of love, that creates a bond of love with that person. And if they're able to make a bond of love with someone else, and you're able to continually make these bonds of love, and they're crisscrossing, and they form this fabric of people who are bound together by this love, I think that is the most effective organizing and large-scale change tool that there could be.
So, first of all, that's a beautiful image. Can I sing a line of a song?
Yeah.
Okay. I know this from Teva, but it's in that world. You might know it. If you know it, you can sing along. Deep inside my heart, I've got this everlasting light. It's shining like the sun. It radiates on everyone. And the more that I give, the more I've got to give. It's the way that I live. It's what I'm living for. Okay, that's the song. And a connection that I have to that song, or a thing I think about, and I will ask you a question after that, is that in different times in my life, there have been, you know me, I'm extroverted, I know a lot of people, I spend time with lots of people, I keep in touch with lots of people.
It's something that I incredibly admire about you.
I have had different relationships to it at different times, and this is related to that, which is that there have been some people in my life, sometimes they've been people with whom I've been in relationships, but not always, sometimes just friends, who I think have found that really challenging about me, and have been like, I don't, like, you know, speaking as a friend, like, I have room for, you know, this number of friends, and you have so many people in your life, and, like, it makes me unsure if I am a special person in your life, or, like, how you know that you care about me, or whatever, and I think it took me a lot of, first of all, it took me a lot of times of hearing that to, like, understand that was, like, a real feeling and a real anxiety and something to, like, honor and listen to. And it took me even longer to understand that, like, the way that I conceive of and experience, like, love and friendship is in, a positive feedback looping way where, like, the more, like, truly the more that I love, the more I have to love. And okay, that's what I figured out after many years. And I also, in the last several years, also had a like, oh, but that is true to a point, because there is also a point at which I'm like, I feel like I'm not giving the people who I owe or who I want to be giving, like, all the things to as much as I want to be giving, because I have too much that I'm trying to do people wise so my question for you is, like, when we think about the positive feedback loops and the negative feedback loops, and the core question here about owing people things, like, feel free to take this whatever direction you want. Like, what are the things in your life or your friendships or your relationships to other human beings who you know that exist in, like, a positive feedback looping category, and or what are the things that exist in a negative feedback loop category?
Yeah.
It can be as specific or as general or as anything as you want.
It's really hard to know, because I think one difficult thing about myself is that I believe and know that the good things in my life, through experience, I know that the good things in my life, you know, as they say, the good leads to good, and bad leads to bad. But it's, I feel like there's a big part maybe of the way I was raised within capitalism, or maybe there's something deeper in the human soul or something. But it's the doubts are so powerful, and it's very hard for me to tell when the doubts are true. But in fact, whenever I experiment, in each case, it proves to be a positive feedback loop. Whenever I experiment, whenever I say, I've had enough, let me take a break and do bad things. It always proves again how true it is for everything. And I also am very afraid. I'm afraid that the more I do something, the less energy I'll have to do it. And if there's a limit, I very rarely reach it because I always stop myself beforehand.
In a good way, like a self-control way, or in a like you stop yourself before you allow yourself to find out what a limit of something is.
I think, I don't know, in like a doubt that it could really be this simple and this good.
We have a moment of choice right now. Our choice is, our moment is, do we want to keep moving on this question? Either way is fine. Do you want to keep moving on this question, or do we want to choose our other question, and also inevitably it'll all be related?
Yeah, I think the second one. I think it's okay. Good to inject a new...
some new energy?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm gonna give us a random number again. Random. That's funny, because there's actually some ways in which this is harder in person, logistically, specifically. Like, not just... Oh, interesting. Okay, I'm excited to talk about this with you. Can you read number one?
Is it possible not to mythologize the dead?
I'm sure that for me this question came from being in a history class at Minerva, where these were the kinds of questions that we would think about. How did this make it onto the shortest version of the short list?
That was the first one that I selected.
Tell me about it.
You know, 2019, whatever.
Yeah, March, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I know we're going to connect this to what we owe each other. I already feel it.
It just jumped out to me as a very good question to open a lot of ideas about the past. Yeah.
Do I have to ask you a more specific question than that? I will. But I also feel like you as archaeologists, for one thing, but also just as person, like...
I could just go off on a rant.
Go start. Give us an opening statement. I'm happy that this is what God chose for our question.
Right. I feel like the way mythologize kind of struck me is where a situation where you take a person who lived in the past and made certain decisions that you can fit within like a story, and then kind of imagine what decisions they would make in this situation, in the present.
Mm-hmm. Like a projection.
Yeah, a projection. Yeah. And it's... I mean, we could go into more examples so that I can convince you that this is one meaning of mythologize. I mean,
I find this an interesting definition.
It's certainly like the way that in Judaism, you know, Devar Torah, or loosely translated sermon, would approach the past. It's, you know, taking a decision or a thought that someone had in a past situation and trying to say this person, them being in the past means that we have to come to respect them for some some reason, and try to think about what they would do in the present. And, you know, as a part of this mythologizing, it usually corresponds to what the person who's doing it thinks
a moralizing
is the right thing.
Sure, I buy that.
Yeah. So it really, I mean, it's impossible to know what a person who is dead would do. It's almost even impossible to know what they did do. It's basically impossible to know what they did do. So, I mean, if we're going to say anything about them, I think it has to include some of the events of the past and the events of the present, and some scrap of evidence that we have about that person, and weaving it into a story that you could call a myth or something.
So, I think... I when I think about this question, first of all, I do like the I like so far thinking about that definition in the way that it pulls in our present like values and our present notions of like decision making or whatever. When I think about this question, okay, look at this spider shadow. It's very cool. When I think about this question, I think about like, well, okay, I guess primarily I think about the dead less as, like, a specific person or set of people, and more as, like, the past as, like, a whole. Mm-hmm. Like, is it possible to not mythologize the past? And then I think, okay, well, what would even be... Why would we... That assumes that we do or don't want to. That assumes that we have, like, a preference to... Or that assumes that we have a tendency to mythologize, and that I'm interested in, like, a preference to not mythologize or something. And so then why would we have that preference? And I guess, I remember a couple months ago, I know this question was from 2 years ago, but I remember a couple months ago, maybe on January 6th, the Capitol riot thing, maybe this is when I was thinking about this, when I was like, wow, I'm living this right now, and I'm already seeing the ways that we are and will spin narratives from this. And I felt super, I remember that night, at someone's advice, like someone who I follow on Instagram, I like wrote down my like my experience of the day and like what I thought happened and what it felt like to like read like head spinning news that was going at a crazy pace and all this stuff. And part of that was because I was like, I don't feel like I don't trust my future self unless I give my future self tools right now that are like, here's what I felt, here's what I was thinking about, whatever. Which is the same reason I journal, I think, because otherwise it's very much too easy for me to like look back and be like, oh, I didn't really feel that way, I didn't really think that way. And instead I'm like, nope, I wrote it. So in that moment of thinking about how we are already making narratives of the present and the past, I remember thinking a lot about like how silly it is that when we think about education is like a thing that happens when you're young. You like get taught and you like go to school, but actually the only way that you could ever possibly hope to understand any piece of history is like through a relationship with someone who is closer to having lived it than you were. So that's a whole thread there, and I think about that just as like what is like responsible storytelling and responsible history is like trying not to mythologize the past, not because there's not because it's morally bad to mythologize, just because it's mostly not true. And it makes me think about, you do a lot of stuff with, like, the very ancient past, and so I'm curious how you think about, like, relationships and, like, how, just, like, all that.
So, right. So, basically, like, the present, which turns into the past as it builds up, is just an unimaginably huge number of data points.
Yeah. The present is. And the past.
Yes, yeah. The present. And I think fundamentally those data points, all the things that are happening at this moment, are fundamentally not connected to each other.
Okay.
If you are to accurately portray what's happening in the present, I think you would have to come to the conclusion that the complexity of the relationship between the things that are happening is so mind-boggling, it's impossible for it ever to be expressed.
Functionally chaotic.
Yeah. But that is, again, we must express it. We must understand it.
As a function of our humanness?
Yes. Uh-huh. I mean, if we want to say anything about it that is at all interesting to us or speaks to our empathy as human beings. And that means organizing these different data points into a coherent narrative, in which one thing leads to another thing, which leads to another thing, with the, you know, the commentary of the story. I think that it's totally impossible with the abilities of a human, or even, yeah, fine, let's just settle with the abilities of a human for now. To create that narrative, which isn't in a huge way false.
Yeah, I definitely strongly agree with that.
And so then you have to decide. Like, there's a few ways to decide. Like, knowing that there's infinitely many narratives that can be used to string together these facts, why am I choosing one or another?
Yeah.
Over another? And I think the most powerful reason in general is, like, which one speaks to my empathy the best? Which one can I imagine the best? As, which one can I put myself into the best?
Do you find that is the guiding principle that you are most often using when you are stringing together a narrative about the present, or is it the one that you aspire to be using, or, like, what is your, yeah, I don't know if you have an answer to that. I don't know that I have an answer to that.
Yeah, definitely. No, it's a big part of both my work and my relationships to the present and to other people. I feel drawn to narratives that speak to my sense of empathy. But also, like, one other question on this thing that I think I italicized as being one that I was less excited for was about practices to build empathy.
Yeah.
And I think this is hugely important to creating narratives that can be the most powerful for the most people and for uniting the most people in sort of common empathy and therefore common cause or common sense of urgency for good that needs to be done. And I think one thing that's very powerful for me is just talking and listening listening to as many people as possible, and especially people who are doing something that you can't empathize with, and talking to them and figuring out the reasoning until you can, and then knowing and being able to incorporate that.
So we were talking yesterday about coming to the lake every day, and I was saying that that's something that, like, of course I'm so happy that I do and grateful that I do, and also, like, I think it is in relationship with the fact that I, like, don't think that I, this is a whole other conversation, but that I don't think that I, like, actively seek out things that, like, push myself to be in conversations with, like, different kinds of people or to be in new types of situations, and I think that has become even more true over the last over the last year. And my connection between that and what you're saying is that I feel like that I think it makes I think that that I don't know if uniformity is so fair to say, but that, like, relative uniformity of, like, what I see and what I do makes this one thing feel coherent and everything else feel chaotic. Like, makes it feel very hard to write a narrative either based on empathy or based on some other type of guiding principle, because, like, this is the thing that makes sense, and, like, everything else just feels like it's, like, a million data points in, like, five-dimensional space. I don't know. Does that, I'm curious, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that really draws and inspires me about this community is that it does include a lot of really different people who have really different motivations, and that's a really powerful thing. And my normal way of going through the world is being very invested in one-time conversations with people, which I think is, like, is very eye-opening.
In one-time conversations, what do you mean? Like, with people who you're not necessarily going to see or meet again, but, like, talking to them. I'm curious how that exists in relationship with you. Laura, how would you define relationship? Like, when you say, like, you were talking earlier about the net, like, a network and a web of relationships, and that is, like, the thing that creates more capacity for more goodness in the world. And when I usually think of that, I think of that as, like, a relationship is something that has more than one data point conversation. But
right,
curious how you.
Well, one thing that I've been, I guess, considering is, like, yeah, it's, like, sort of related to what you were saying about Minerva and going to many different places for a short period of time, even though, you know, 4 months isn't so short. There's a whole other level of empathy that you can achieve with someone in the second time. And then there's a whole other level of empathy that you can achieve with someone on the third time. And you know, and on and on.
Multiplying depth.
Yeah. But I suppose that's one instance where, you know, going back to our previous conversation, where you have to choose where you can do the most good.
What question are we even in right now? I can't even remember.
Mythologizing the past.
Oh, yeah.
But we got pretty far afield, I think.
Do you have a connection that you want to make between what we are on now and what and that question? Let me think.
Well, for my relationship with the past, empathy being a big driver in the narratives that I make about the past, including in my work, making those narratives and as a part of making those narratives, like, listening to whatever evidence that I find is also another important practice for me in increasing the ways that I can be empathetic and increasing the amount, the variety of narratives that I can construct, and making my commentary on them that ties them together as empathetic as possible. And as
in a way that you feel like does or doesn't mythologize? Or how would you describe the quality, the that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I shy away from mythologizing. I mean, I don't think I shy away from it because I don't think it's impossible. I don't think it's possible not to. And I think as long as we're doing it, we might as well be doing it in the most compelling or best or most good, inspiring way possible.
Do you feel like, is your experience of the present and this and the making a narrative in the present, like, I liked a lot what you said about, like, okay, there's no actual way to do this that is, like, correct or that, like, actually is, like, the true narrative. Like, there's not, like, there's just too many data points and they're too chaotically connected to each other or whatever. Like, do you feel like you are successful at, or okay, actually rather I think what I want to ask is, are there times or kinds of times when you feel like it is harder for you to have, like, an empathetic framework as, like, the way that you are creating a narrative about the present between many unconnected things? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Are there times that is relatively more challenging for you?
Yeah, it's a thought-provoking question. I am gonna have to take a second.
Yeah, take your. We can listen to the wind.
Yeah, I mean, maybe not with the present, but I mean, like, thinking about genocide and specifically, I think. Thinking about genocide is something that I do a lot. And partially because it's very difficult for me to think about it empathetically. And that makes it feel important for me to figure out how to do it. Because also, like, I think part of thinking about things empathetically is sort of the first step in shaping the future to have things happen differently. Because I kind of think that, like, if the event is not understood empathetically for all of its actors, then it's not understood and it can't be fixed. So that is one area where I struggle, and but that just makes it seem more important to me.
Empathetically, in a necessarily emotional, like, how can I have empathy for the individuals who committed X, Y, or Z acts, or empathy in, like, a larger scale, like, I have empathy for the ways that societies act and the ways that people fall into, like, do you know what I'm...
Yeah, I think that it's... I don't think that it's... At least in my experience, I don't think that it's possible to feel empathy with a society. I think it's possible to feel empathy only with a human being. And that definitely contributes to the way that I think about problems or think about events, is that I... Even if there's something that it seems like society is doing all at once, you know... One thing that I push myself to do is think about what is each individual thinking and being motivated by that allows this to happen or that causes this to happen. And right. Yeah, what are those motivations? Can we understand them? Can we change them? Can we right.
So okay. The two questions that we I'm processing a lot. The two questions that we had talked about were, what do we owe whom, and is it possible to not mythologize the dead? So, we're almost at time. This isn't time. There's a couple minutes. That's buffer time. but before we get to our closing.
But by the way, I'm very, very sad that this is ending.
Yeah. Well, luckily. I know that you're leaving for a time, but luckily our friendship is longer than 1 hour.
Yeah.
That's what I get to think every week when I'm like, wow, no, we don't get to... And then I'm like, yes, we do. The whole reason that I'm even talking to you is the reason that... But yes, I hear that. Before we come to our closing things, I guess the question that I would ask us to think about and speak on is, are there not answers or summaries to either of those, but what are the threads that we want to leave each other with from each of those questions? Or from either. It doesn't have to be both. From either of those questions. I know for the second one, I'm thinking about the question of, like, chaotic data points versus coherent data points in the present, and, like, actually, like, what do we owe ourselves in terms of, like, having empathetic frameworks for, like, making narratives of the present and the past. That's, I feel like, a big, major thread from both of those questions for me.
Yeah.
You just got...
Yeah, that seems to draw together a bunch of the things we have been talking about. I think... Right. I think one thing that I maybe can draw together is, like, maybe the idea that the things that are happening and the reality that we live in and the community of people on Earth is extremely complex, but and also therefore, like, the connections and the communities that we can make can also be similarly complex based on the ways we just interact with each other on a daily basis, maybe as fruit for thinking about what those ways are
I'm in. I didn't ask you about this beforehand, so you can say no if you don't want this sprung upon you, but something that I have done in many episodes of this is, for the questions that didn't make it onto the show but were on the shortlist, we do, like, a little lightning round.
Oh, sure.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. And then
I'll probably say pass on most of them.
Yeah, that's fine. How do we... Okay, but it has to be fast.
Yeah.
I know that's anti. How do we arrive at the frameworks that we find useful, and why are frameworks a helpful thing?
Oh, big question.
Big question. All right. What would have to happen for the world in terms of norms, etc., to meaningfully change?
I think that we kind of talked about this, but I think one big thing is this, like, scarcity mentality, the idea that we can do good and increase the amount of good in the world.
Is there anything emancipatory about capitalism?
Yes, I think there is. And that would be things that people can do on an individual level that aren't possible in other scenarios, but taking away things that people can do that are much grander on a relationship,
like,
level.
Personally emancipatory. What are the unexpected consequences, bad and good, of this all?
Yeah, unexpected consequences is something that I find to be a very useful idea, and it's something that I think a lot about, and I put into my work a lot, and you never know. You never know. That's why they're unexpected.
Why aren't all scientists historians and philosophers? By the way, are you a scientist or a historian?
I'm definitely not a scientist.
Cool.
I'm a historian. Science, like many, many other things in our society, has become very specialized and mechanized, and to its detriment.
What is underneath our layers that we present? Why do layers build up? And how do we get them to come off, stay off?
Yeah, this we talked about yesterday, we talked about maybe if sometimes feeling totally present and within self might have to do with going beyond self in some situations.
And the last one that I will ask, should one fight one's inclinations? How do you decide when or when not?
I mean, I'm a big yes on this.
You should fight your inclinations.
Yes. I really think that being a good person is hard.
Okay, so the last two questions that go in this are... I know I asked you this yesterday and you didn't have an answer, and that's fine. So if you want to continue to not have an answer, that's fine. But what is a question... What is a question that you have? That's the whole question.
A question that I have is how can a person balance the hope for the future and the being in the present?
Yeah. I'm into that too. And the last little piece is, who is someone who you want to hear on the show?
Matthew.
My father?
Yeah.
All right, I'll write it down. Wow. Akiva, thank you for this conversation.
I feel like it went by so quickly.
Yeah.
It's really...
I do too.
I feel like a lot of times in my life when things that are really amazing are happening, they slip so quickly.
Yeah.
And I'm always like, did I take the best advantage of that?
I think about this constantly. I think it's a bad way to think about time. I try to get myself to stop. But this was really fun. And I like your brain and talking to you. And I'm going to miss you. I know that not everything has to turn to that, but it's on my mind due to the leaving. But mostly I appreciate this conversation. And that we really did this in the 11th hour of being in the same place.
Don't miss me too much.
Because you'll be back.
Because...
Then I won't be in the president. That's my hope for the future, is that you'll come back. All right. I'm going to kill it. Any final anythings?
No.
All right. We're out.
And you know the light is fading all too soon. You're just two umbrellas one late afternoon. You don't know the next thing you will say. This is your favorite kind of day. It has no walls. The beauty of the rain is how it falls, how it falls, how it falls. And there's nothing wrong, but there is something more. And sometimes you wonder what you love her for. She says you've known her deepest fears, 'cause she showed you a box of stained glass tears. It can't be, oh, the truth about the rain.